From the late 1800s to the early 1900s, a bloodthirsty killer was haunting the streets of Marrakesh, snatching up unsuspecting young girls who found themselves in his path. The man responsible blended into the background. He was part of the community, which allowed him to effectively lie in wait for his preferred victims. But in 1906, his reign of terror finally came to an end, and the true extent of the lives he stole came to light. After learning of his crimes, the community wanted justice, or perhaps vengeance is the more accurate word. And the Marrakesh arch killer was made to face an unthinkable punishment for his crimes. Welcome to a brand new episode of Sinister Mosaic. I'm your host, Dalal, and I'm flying solo today. I'm recording by myself. We actually recorded this episode, Oscar and I, a while ago, but there was so much background noise. We were having trouble with our equipment, so we had to re-record. And I thought that if I record it with him again, it wouldn't be his genuine reaction. So I thought I'd record this episode by myself. This story is really unique. It's from the late 1900s. It's a story where the punishment really fits the crime. It's the punishment is more insane than the crimes, I should say. So without further ado, I'm not going to stretch the intro too much. Let's dive into today's case. Little is known about Haj Muhammad Misfawi. He was born sometimes between the 1850s and the 1870s, and he grew up in the city he would later terrorize, Marrakesh, Morocco. Today, Marrakesh is Morocco's fourth largest city and is considered one of the four imperial cities. It falls west of the North African Atlas Mountain and is home to roughly 1 million people. Marrakesh was once the country's capital and still holds the title of the most famous city today, bringing in millions of visitors annually who want to experience the culture and atmosphere the Red City has to offer. As an adult, Misfawi worked as a shoemaker and had a small shop in the city that he worked in. Misfawi also used his ability to read and write to his advantage, offering his writing services to the public who needed letters dictated on their behalf. During this time, Marrakesh was dealing with a major crime problem. The volume of trading being done in the city meant that foreigners came and went within days, making it nearly impossible to solve any crimes they may have committed. The same went for those who called Marrakesh home. They could also slip out of the city at the drop of a hat until enough time has passed to where they felt safe to return. So, when families began reporting their daughters missing, no one knew where to start looking. It was as if they had simply been swallowed up by the hustle and bustle of the crowded city marketplace, never to be seen again. From late 1890 to 1906, roughly 40 women were reported missing by their families. As the numbers racked up, the authorities were no closer to finding out what was happening to these women, nor did they suspect they were all victims of the same man. They came to the conclusion that they had likely been kidnapped by traders who passed through, writing off the chance of ever finding them again. It seemed the number of missing women was going to continue to pile up until one family led the authorities to the last known place their daughter had been before she vanished. A certain shop owned by a cobbler and a letter writer. Early one summer morning, a young woman entered Miss Fowey's shop hoping to have a letter dictated. She was greeted by an elderly woman sitting behind the counter. Anna Rahali was in her 70s and worked as the shopkeeper. Who would have thought that this woman, who may reminded customers of their own grandmother, was acting as an accomplice to the monster who lurked in the back of the store. The teenager approached Rahali and asked if she could have a letter dictated. Rahali said, of course, telling the girl she would pass the message on to the writer, who was busy in his workshop. She then disappeared into the back, before returning a few minutes later with the letter in hand. Rahali then asked the girl for the payment, which she handed over. The letter was then given to her, but before she could turn to leave, Rahali made an offer. She asked the teenager if she would like to come upstairs and have lunch with her. She had been preparing soup and bread, which would soon be ready, but she needed help getting up the stairs. Rahali told the girl that the man in the back was busy and couldn't help her. Initially, the girl was reluctant. She hadn't eaten that morning, though, so her stomach eventually made the decision for her. She likely also thought Rahali, an elderly woman, was trustworthy. Rahali asked the girl to help her up the stairs, which she did. Lunch was almost ready, so she sat politely waiting for her plate while she made small talk with the old woman. Halfway through her meal, she felt a wave of exhaustion fall over her. It was as if she couldn't keep her head up, and soon she was asleep on the table. But this wasn't the after effect of a healthy meal on an empty stomach or the result of exhaustion from a hot summer day. She had been drugged, and as she slipped unconscious, Miss Fowey made his way up the stairs with a large knife in hand. By that evening, the family of the girl had grown increasingly worried about her sudden disappearance. It was not like her to not be home on time, and she was due back hours ago. In the days that followed, repeated attempts to get an interest from the authorities had failed. They gave the impression that it was not their job to track down a young woman that the family should have kept an eye on. Whether or not the family had heard about the slew of missing women is unknown, but they were determined to find out what had happened to their girl. And it didn't take them too long. There were few places they knew their daughter was visiting that morning, and methodically they visited each establishment asking if they had seen the girl and what time she had left their store. Slowly they whittled it down to one last spot, the writer's shop. The girl's father and her three brothers entered the store and were greeted by Rahali. She asked them how she could help them, assuming the group was there for either some new shoes or the writer's services. They told Rahali that they were looking for a young woman who had been in their shop just days prior, adding that they believed this to be the very last shop she visited before she was supposed to return home. The letter had been the last thing she needed to do that morning, the father stressed. He then asked Rahali what she knew about his daughter and whether she had any information for him. Of course, Rahali knew exactly what had happened to the man's daughter, but she wasn't about to come clean to her father and brothers. She tried to keep her cool, but it wasn't working. Rahali was visibly flustered and told the man that while she had seen the girl, she had no idea where she ended up after she left the store. The father stared at Rahali, wondering why she seemed so worked up at the mention of his daughter. Something in his gut told him she knew more than she was letting on, and by now he was desperate to find out the truth. Sources differ on what happened next. Some suggest the girl's family grabbed Rahali and took her to the authorities, while others say they took her back to their home for questioning. Either way, the questioning began calmly, with Rahali being asked to tell them what she knew about the girl. No matter what they said to her, she refused to offer any information other than what she had already told them. She left the store. Rahali insisted, I don't know what happened to her. Growing tired of her story, the questioning became violent. Rahali had her feet repeatedly flogged until she finally broke. It was Haj Muhammad Misfawi. He was the one responsible for the girl's disappearance, Rahali admitted. The authorities now had a name to follow up on, and they could no longer push disappearances aside. Rahali didn't stop at giving them Misfawi's name. She also confessed to the crimes he had committed with her help. Misfawi used his position as a public writer to his advantage, knowing that people would come right to him. His preferred victims were women between the ages of 16 and 24. Once they would come in, he would have Rahali drug them before he would take whatever money they had, and then, using a knife, Misfawi beheaded the young women. And once night fell, he would bury them. The authorities hunted down Misfawi and brought him into custody. Initially, much like Rahali, he denied any involvement in the disappearances. Even when the authorities told him what Rahali had admitted to, he didn't break. That is when the torture started. Eventually, the pain grew too severe for Misfawi. He admitted to being responsible for the disappearances. And in case you were worried that this is a case of coerced confession, he then agreed to take the authorities to the remains. 10 of the women had been buried beneath his shop, while the other 26 were found either in Misfawi's backyard or further out into the surrounding hillsides. News quickly spread through Marrakesh of Misfawi's capture. He was soon dubbed the Marrakesh Archkiller and scheduled to be put to death for his crimes on the 2nd of May 1906. Despite the nature of his crimes, protests from foreigners living in the city put off his execution. They felt it was inhumane to kill a criminal by crucifying him, regardless of what crime he had committed. However, Marrakesh locals felt very differently. It was their daughters who had been targeted, and they wanted vengeance. They wanted Misfawi to suffer in the way they had been made to suffer from his actions. Their own protests meant the case was put before a judge. While he waited on the decision, Misfawi had to endure rather unfavorable conditions in prison. He was treated worse than others, and they themselves made sure Misfawi knew how hated he was. After the initial protests, Misfawi was set to be beheaded, but the public desire for his torture meant that he had to endure daily lashings from a thorn-filled acacia tree branch. Every morning, Misfawi was led from his cell to the market square where his punishment was inflicted. This went on for 4 weeks before a judge decided that he should be used as a warning to others in the city who wished to commit murders for their own gain. He was sentenced to be walled alive for his crimes. The gruesome spectacle began in the Marrakesh Marketplace Bazaar on June 11, 1906. Two stone masons greeted a cell of sorts in one of the thick walls that lined the marketplace streets. It was just 2 foot deep and 2 foot high. The back wall featured two heavy chains affixed to it, which were fastened to Misfawi once he was placed inside. It meant he could not escape the cell and he had to remain standing. As he was walked from his cell to the marketplace, Misfawi reportedly begged for mercy and weakly struggled with the jailers who escorted him. There was no mercy waiting for him from the public, though. Once he had been chained inside, Misfawi had abuses hurled at him, along with rotten food. As the locals watched on, the stonemasons began placing bricks in front of Misfawi. One by one, the bricks neared closer to his face, before Misfawi found himself completely walled in. While he screamed, the public cheered. He could be heard for the next 2 days before he fell silent on the third. Haj Muhammad Musfawi died on June 13, 1906, paying the ultimate price for his heinous actions. And this right here brings our story to an end. What do you guys think of this punishment? Did the judge go overboard, or did he deserve what he got? Let me know your thoughts below. Comment, subscribe, follow us for more content. I'll be posting again next week. I have a story for you from Egypt. Please let me know your thoughts. And thank you all for tuning in. I will see you in the next one. Bye.